28th is right?
28th.
Okay. It's about 1:30, and we're at the Federal Reserve representing the FCIC, Joel Miller, Alexis
Simmendinger with FCIC.
Thank you. And Randall Dodd on speakerphone, and with the Board of Governors.
Dave Caperton with Board Legal.
Michael Palumbo, Research and Statistics.
Patrick McCabe, Research and Statistics.
All right, thank you. And we appreciate your taking the time to meet with us. We hope this is an informal conversation rather than a formal interview. What we're doing at the FCIC is collecting information that pertains to the financial crisis, trying to make sure that we get our facts straight in terms of events that happened and actions that the Fed and others took at various points in time. And we're interested in your perspective and in your respective subject areas. So we sent you a list of questions that should cover the topics that we're going to focus on.
And see that? Under that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's focus, I guess, for each of you, if you could run through a very quick bio, your higher education, if you got a master's or PhD, briefly where you worked, and then how your career progressed here at the Fed.
Okay, I'll begin. Michael Palumbo. I have a PhD in economics from the University of Virginia. I was assistant professor and then associate professor at the University of Houston in the economics department, and then came to the Federal Reserve in 1999 and was in the macroeconomic analysis section for 3 years, and then became chief of the flow funds section, all in the research and statistics division in 2002, and then was chief of flow funds until summer of 2007, and became assistant director on the official staff of the board in the research division in the summer of 2007, and now I'm deputy associate director in the research division, also still on the official staff of the board in the research division.
And just one quick question. Does the flow of funds section report to you?
Yeah, flow funds section reports to me now. Yeah, the chief of the section is Josh Gallen is chief and assistant director, so he's also on the official staff, and then he reports to me.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'm Patrick McCabe. I'm a senior economist in the flow funds section in research and statistics, as I've mentioned before. My PhD came from University of California, Berkeley, and joined board staff in 2000. I've worked in the flow of funds section since then.
Okay. I think most of the questions, since they do pertain to flow of funds, I'm not sure who the primary person will be, but
for the money fund stuff, Patrick is really going to be the main person. I think, as I understood most of the questions you have, Patrick's probably the main person, and I'll just chime in occasionally as sort of needed.
Okay. And we're focused on the period, sort of the tail end of 06, just to sort of put things in perspective, but then really focusing principally starting in the summer of 07 through early 2009. So I guess prior to 2007, were either of you involved in any situations where there were flow of fund issues while you were here at the board?
I don't know. So the flow of funds is a quarterly statistical release produced by the board 4 times a year. It basically is a macroeconomic accounting of financing. The major sectors of the economy who are providing financing to other sectors, and where the financing is coming from for the major sectors, and then what form financing is taking, whether it be bank loans or corporate bonds or mortgages or consumer credit. So in that sense, it's an ongoing statistical operation, and so it's been in existence, I believe, since the late 1950s, and and is continuing to this day. So in a sense, it's an ongoing work that just produces a body of information that's used by researchers and analysts around the world, really.
Okay, I guess I'm using flow of funds in a much narrower
right.
sense.
That's what than I mean,
here, so I appreciate putting it in context.
So maybe we can give you a flavor of
okay.
some of the so specifically regarding money funds, which seem to be the focus
right.
of you. There have been numerous topics that have come up over time, and hence our tracking of these funds. So in September 2001, there were massive inflows to the funds following the terrorist attacks. In 2002 and 2003, as interest rates came down, as the federal funds rate target came down, there were concerns that the funds revenues would be squeezed because of the low yields that they earn on their instruments, so we followed that as well. So there have been numerous issues. I'm not sure whether those rise to the level where you would be interested in them, though.
Well, definitely the 9/11
mm-hmm.
gave, I guess, all of us a sense of, I mean, what a flight to what? How would you describe it when people are
so we typically will call these types of flows safe haven flows or flights to quality. Keep in mind that after 9/11, the flows came primarily to prime funds, which are funds that hold private debt instruments like commercial paper and bank CDs. That's where we saw most of the growth. So it wasn't to the very safest of the safe assets. So when we say safe haven flows, that's a general term.
Okay.
And it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily an attempt on our part to say that, hey, that asset was safe or wasn't safe. But that seems to be what was going on. At the same time, you saw big outflows from, say, stock mutual funds.
So then I'll move up into 2007 then, and again focusing more on money funds and flow of funds. In terms of, do you track in any broad macro sense what these funds invest in? Is that something that you do?
Yes, we do. In the flow of funds, that's actually one of the tables. If you turn on the tables to either F-121 or L-121, you'll see on a quarterly basis in broad categories what they hold, so commercial paper or treasury securities, agency, GSE securities, that sort of thing. So you'll see in broad brush what they hold. We also track on a more high frequency basis, depending on need, what the funds hold using commercial data available from MyMoneyNet, which provides sort of similar.
But it's not securities level.
No.
That analysis. It's not. We're not talking about in general at the securities level. We're talking about in the asset class category, commercial paper, asset-backed commercial paper, certificates
right.
of deposit,
right.
repurchase agreements. We're really much more aggregative in terms of the analysis and the information that we're generally using on a regular basis.
And the data on the fund-specific holdings is available in their annual reports and semi-annual reports, which are much more difficult to essentially aggregate for purposes of current analysis. They're very lagged and so forth. And so there's difficulties there. But these are the things that we primarily track.
And I guess what I need to understand is how broadly you view money funds. Because when I'm thinking of money funds, there's 2A7 funds.
Right.
And then there's prime or enhanced funds. And there's bank-sponsored short-term collective investment funds. And there are other unregistered, 3A1 and 3C7 funds, all of which have, or some of which have characteristics like money funds. So what do you, when you talk about money funds, how broadly do you view those?
I think first
we would be very cautious about using the term money fund to characterize anything broader than the 2A7 regulated registered money market funds. There are a number of unregistered products. I mean, local government investment pools is another, offshore money market funds and so forth, that compete with money funds but aren't subject to the same types of restrictions that money funds would be. We have far less data on those, kind of that broader circle of funds. And indeed, in 2007, when those funds started to experience serious problems, you didn't have the kind of systemic response that you did when a money fund had a problem in September 2008. I think it's not just us, but also to some extent investors that distinguish these funds. But there's considerably less data on them.
But when we're talking about money funds, we're almost, unless we make an explicit exception, we're talking about registered 2A7 funds.
Okay.
The tables that I just mentioned to you in the flow of funds?
Yep.
2A7 funds.
Right. That's the... You know, in 2007, that's the $3.7 trillion asset class.
So in terms of some of these prime and enhanced yield funds, which...
Enhanced cash, maybe?
Enhanced cash, thank you, which got pretty large in the aggregate amount. Those are not included when you're talking about...
So when we say prime is a term that we would use for the 2A7 funds. So there's a we classify 2A7 funds into prime and into government funds.
Right.
Since the government funds are holding treasury and agency securities almost exclusively. And then the prime funds are the ones that also would hold unsecured paper, certificates of deposit, and asset-backed paper and things like that. Oh, and then a wider range of repo collateral as well.
And then there would be tax-exempt money market funds as well.
And that would be the third group that we would characterize. So in our nomenclature, prime is a large subcategory of the 2A7 funds, just to be clear.
Okay. And would you... I mean, are these generally considered more retail-oriented funds or institutional?
Well, it depends on the time frame you're looking at. I think I'd have to see the latest data. I believe about two-thirds of the assets are institutional funds.
As of?
I know the data. I have it right here.
Okay.
So I'm looking at a recent paper that Patrick wrote. That was how I prepared for this.
Is this one that just got published?
Yes, it just came up last week, I think.
So can we just say for the record what document we're looking at?
Yeah, we're looking at, it's a working paper from the Federal Reserve called The Cross-Section of Money Market Fund Risks and Financial Crises. Author is Patrick McCabe. It's paper 210-51, and it was published in the Finance and Economics Discussion Series, I think last week, right, Patrick? September 2010. So in here there is a... I thought there was a retail, there we go, institutional retail split. So as of August 2010, there's about $1 trillion of institutional prime money market funds. And then there's about $600 billion of retail prime money market funds.
Was your question about total money market fund assets or prime money market fund assets?
Right.
That would be... So those two categories combined would be about 1.6 out of the $2.8 trillion of money market funds.
Unless I qualify it, I guess that I'll be asking about what you call prime funds, because we're not really focused on...
The government funds.
Unless you're aware of problems that we haven't...
There were problems in...
There were problems in the Gavi ones also?
There were problems in tax-exempt funds, too.
In tax-exempt, okay.
I mean, so
we'll come back to those.
Right.
Obviously less severe than the ones that you're focusing on.
So as part of your work, did you look, though, outside of the prime... 2A7 funds at unregistered funds offered exclusively to large institutional customers?
Yeah, absolutely, to the extent that we could. Again, subject to data limitations, subject to the fact that these funds are offered to a clientele that does not rely on, you know, SEC registration, doesn't rely on the types of quarterly portfolio reports that are required for 2A7 funds and so forth. So as the investors don't necessarily know, neither do we, what those funds held. We watched them quickly run into problems in late 2007 and looked at, you know, with some alarm at what was going on there, but also with a clear recognition that these were not the 2A7 funds that were the parking place for investor cash that was, I think, looking for less risk. Remember how these things were marketed, right? They were marketed to a slightly higher yield-seeking investor that was willing to take on a little more risk.
Okay. So, focusing on your observation that especially as we got later into 2007, some of these unregistered institutional investor-only funds ran into some problems. I guess, what type of problems did you see? What caused those problems? To the extent you can generalize it.
I think they were holding, this is based on some considerable information that we were looking at a considerable time ago, so my memory may be imperfect here, but they were holding the types of securities that got some money funds into trouble, but holding considerably larger quantities of them. They had, for example, guidelines that sometimes allow them to hold securities with much longer maturities than a money fund would hold, riskier securities and so forth. So there would be some commonality, but they'd also be holding asset-backed securities, other types of securities that money funds could not have held.
Okay. You say riskier securities. What would be some examples that you remember that caused some problems?
I'm going to have to take a pass on
that. I just don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah,
no,
we could go back and look at the Columbia, Cash Strategies Fund,
right,
or whatever,
okay,
what they were holding. That would be a matter of public record,
right,
I think, at this
so
point.
So if I threw out a term, SIVs, structured investment.
Of course.
As I
noted earlier, the money funds would have held some of the same things. It's not clear to me, when you say SIV, SIVs would issue both paper as well as notes.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be very careful about what class of securities you're talking about.
Because some of that is eligible for a 2A7 fund and some is not. Is that what you're driving at? Okay. Did you see a run-up in investments in some of these riskier securities in 2006 or 2007?
Run up in, I'm sorry,
in the enhanced cash funds, and is that what you mean?
In enhanced cash or in your the prime funds?
Okay.
Did you see, in either category, did you see greater concentration, reaching for yield, whatever it may have been? Did you see that happen as you monitored these?
So for the enhanced cash funds, remember we weren't. I don't think we would have been specifically monitoring what they were holding.
Okay.
We saw their
right.
assets come up.
Right.
For prime funds, we saw ABCP holdings come up, but we have imperfect data on that in the aggregate, too. So,
but in general, prime money funds balances were rising strongly in 2006, and then I think
right
all the way through the latter half of 2008, really into the fall
right.
of 2008. So those funds are growing, not as much in 2006. It was really more over the course of 2007 and the first half of 2008. Prime money funds are actually attracting investments over that time period. I don't think that was a reach for yield phenomenon necessarily. I mean, but I don't.
Okay. One component is you have more investors putting more assets into these funds, and I guess
mm-hmm.
you know that data, you know, is easier for us to get.
Right.
You know, investment company institute or
right,
et cetera. But I guess what I'm focusing on is the type of assets these funds themselves invested in. in your opinion, did you see them reaching for yield by investing in assets that may have been higher risk?
Well, in cross-section, we did, in the sense that we saw funds that had higher yields that were more attractive to investors, and hence to the extent that markets are efficient, we're taking riskier securities. And a good example of that is the reserve fund itself. And ICI, in the report of their money market fund working group, I believe, has documented a change in reserves portfolio management strategy towards moving towards riskier assets, and we did see that.
Did you see it beyond outside of the reserve fund? Was this
in time series? Not really. I'm not. Yeah.
Because reserve, from what I'm recalling, because I've been looking at this recently,
yeah,
probably more than you. You know, they did shift their investment
indeed
strategy.
Yes.
Right. They were not in CP before, commercial paper before then, and they started getting heavily into that.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you looked at other funds or if.
The share of fund assets held in ABCP was growing over time.
Okay.
But.
So what did you think about that at the time, if anything?
I don't think we. Yeah.
Okay.
What do you mean that you didn't think about it? I just want to make sure I understand. You didn't think of it as an unusual.
Trying to think back in the time.
Yeah, I'm just struggling to. Did we actually look at the share of ABCP held by the funds? My recollection would be no. I mean, we did at times, but I don't think we looked at it in time series per se.
So then let's focus, starting in, I guess, the summer of 2007, the Bear Stearns hedge funds blew up in July, and French Bank had a problem, I think,
BNP Paribas
in July, maybe. So starting around then, people in various sectors started enter into, or unusual transactions seem to start taking place. I guess what did you see in the money fund space?
Right.
If anything. So this is, you know, summer of 2007.
So August of 2007. What we saw, a couple of things. One was that there was, we discussed earlier, flight to quality, safe haven flows. Now, instead of the money going to prime funds, or to money funds in general, we saw very large inflows to government-only funds and to treasury-only funds. We did see a little bit of pullback from the prime funds out of concern about their exposures to ABCP and CIS, in particular other distressed ABCP, but nothing overwhelming. And then the reports started coming out about funds having to support, fund sponsors having to support the funds.
And about when was that?
I'd have to just say the second half of 2007.
Okay. Yeah. I forgot to say at the beginning of our taping that this is covered under our confidentiality agreement, right? This conversation and confidential information. And you know, Friday, I neglected to say for the interview with Nellie Lang and Dan Corbitz that that conversation, I mean, it's all assumed, but I want it on record that that conversation is covered by our confidentiality agreement. Sorry.
Yes, absolutely. And I will pass along, Dave, your comment about the other interviews on Friday, so that everyone is aware of that.
Perfect.
Thanks. So, second half of 2007. Some pullback, some support being provided.
Right.
So how would you find out about a fund sponsor supporting a fund?
I believe, I have to think back on this, but most of it actually came from the press. There were announcements. I'm trying to... It's hard to think back in real time,
right,
what we were learning from home. We had regular conversations with people, with staff at the SEC, although that picked up a little later. as well as with New York Fed.
Mm-hmm. So you said the SEC picked up later.
Our conversations with the SEC.
Yeah, we would be
later in 07 or later. Maybe
probably 2008.
Certainly by 2008. You know, we had we were speaking with the SEC contacts regularly.
I bet it probably started
in the second half.
The real conversations with the SEC began in like 2003 when there were those concerns about the money funds' low yields. It's very difficult for me to think back
on
who we talked to about these things when.
But we have contacts with the New York Fed, and we would speak with them, and the SEC would be our main sources of information, I think, for really detailed things that were happening at the fund level or the sponsor level. It would typically be the SEC.
But keep in mind that the industry doesn't even necessarily report this to the SEC, right? So when there is a intervention by a sponsor, it's not necessary in all cases that that intervention even be reported to the SEC. When it was reported to the SEC, the SEC generally saw those reports as confidential. In some cases saw those as confidential. In other cases, posted information to its website with some lag.
Okay.
But there wasn't necessarily an announcement to us.
Right.
We're not a regulator for money funds, right?
Yes.
So at the New York Fed, which group would you work with?
The Markets Group.
Markets Group. Markets Group, okay. And then at the SEC, which division over there?
Division of Investment Management.
Okay. Any particular person that you would usually talk with at the SEC?
Bob Plays is the, I believe, the associate director over there.
Okay. So let's say towards the end of 07, there were a number of funds that did obtain support from their sponsor. Just so I get your understanding of it, why would a fund need to obtain support? What would cause that to happen?
Well, there could be a couple of things, but primarily because the so-called shadow NAV of the fund, that is the total market value of its assets divided by the number of shares, was falling below a dollar. And as that shadow NAV approaches 99.5 cents, the fund becomes in danger of having to reprice its shares at 99 cents, and the industry lingo for that is breaking the buck.
So the support that you would get is you would either get an injection of cash from the sponsor, or the sponsor might buy assets out of the fund at above market value. Those would be the kinds of support that generally would be provided.
So there would be no good news reason why this would happen.
Oh, the support? No.
And so I'm just clarifying because I'm part of the writing team.
Okay. Yes.
Investors would not necessarily have to know about this, right? It's not made clear to the investors, correct?
That's right.
Can you speak to what the disclosure disclosure was? This might be something you have to raise with the SEC.
Yeah.
Yes, and then in annual reports, when a fund reports on an annual basis what it's done, it can become clear. You have to go through the annual report to know. Sometimes the sponsor, if you want to know what Credit Suisse had to do to its funds, good place to look is the annual report for the parent company, for the sponsor.
Right.
Now, the funds are all balance sheet, but if support was provided, sometimes that's in the notes in the financial reports of the sponsor. So it varies a little bit, but there's not a good systematic source of information about this. So as an investor, you wouldn't necessarily know whether or not there had been support for the fund. Some fund actions required no action relief from the SEC, and there the SEC in this case had a policy of, as I mentioned, posting those no action letters on its website with some lag, but that's not every form of support. We can go into that, but it is some forms of support.
And then there were also some letters the Fed Board of Governors issued that pertain to support provided by fund affiliates. Were you involved in any of those?
No, I was not.
Well, you have a fund that's advised by a registered advisor that is either a bank subsidiary or a holding company sub, maybe a bank affiliate. Would either the Fed member bank or the holding company advise the Fed, either their reserve bank or somebody here in Washington, that they planned on providing support?
I can't comment on that. That's really a supervisory question.
Yeah.
We're in the Research and Statistics Division, and that type of supervisory information is privileged. So.
Yeah. We don't know.
Okay. So if, I think, Guy, you mentioned the Bank of America, Columbia, what was the fund in late 2007?
Columbia Cash Strategies Fund,
right,
I believe.
Okay, so that one got a lot of press.
Right. Yeah.
So as far as you don't know one
we
way or another
know.
Whether B of A notified either the Richmond Reserve Bank or the D.C. Fed that they were going to provide support.
You know, anecdotally, we would hear, you know, in conversations internally about that type of notification at times, and I cannot tell you honestly.
So let's not speculate.
Yeah,
don't
I can't
for sure. Then let's
yeah, I don't right. know for sure. Yeah,
but it did not come into the research
no.
group, so you didn't tabulate bank support from calls or inquiries coming into you.
Not then.
Okay, and. Did you tabulate them in any way, just based on what you read in the press, that, you know, let's see, B of A supported their fund, and, you know, I'm just making up names
right.
here, Northern supported a fund at the same period of time, State Street. Did you keep track here of who's supporting funds?
There were a couple of different groups that were doing it. I believe somebody in markets in New York was doing that, as well as there was an industry report that was doing the same thing. We weren't independently doing anything more than sort of confirming that what we were hearing about was on those lists
okay.
at the time. So,
so you would look at...
You know, if there's a, yeah. If
there, what was the private report?
Peter Crane
yeah,
was
Crane
made, yeah. And he was doing it, again, it's been a while, but as I recall, he would every now and then put something out, but you could also contact him and he would
right.
send you the latest, what he had, and we'd check, did you catch this, did you catch that? He was pretty good about catching things, so.
Yeah, Pete Crane
yeah.
does a good job.
Right.
I don't know where he gets his information.
A lot of from the same things we've just discussed, right?
Okay.
The annual reports. And
okay, so we're still in late 2007. People like Pete Crane and his report are reporting these events of sponsor support.
I should just interject.
Here.
I do have a spreadsheet where I was tracking this stuff. I just found it redundant. So I think I have, you know, as of some date in 2008... You know, the current, our current list, yeah, tabulation of what we knew and who the sponsors were. But again, I found that to be redundant to
yeah.
what I was getting from them.
So, why would you keep something like that? How would that help you?
Because initially, I wasn't aware of some of the other sources. So I wasn't aware that New York was trying to do the same thing that Pete Crane was doing the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, but how are you using the information?
Yeah. Thanks.
Right.
I think we were just trying to track what was going
yeah.
on in the money fund world, right? So this was of some concern, although, yeah. You know, clearly investors weren't seeing it that way.
Right. So you're keeping track of it. So from your perspective and the research side of the Fed, so why would you be worried about this? Or would you, I mean, was this unusual that there was this many sponsors providing support to funds?
Yes, although unusual, certainly. There have been other episodes where dozens of sponsors have stepped in to support funds. So 1994, you know, comes out as an, I wasn't here, but there were a couple of dozen prime funds that got support. There were like three dozen tax-exempt funds that got support when Orange County blew up.
Yeah. So it is. This would be part of the monitoring that we do for the Board of Governors. Is that when we're observing markets coming under pressure, then we mobilize and we're trying to track as many in real time, as much information that we think is relevant as we can. So this would be just a case where we would have been doing this in the context of our normal market and economic monitoring that we're doing, partly associated with the FOMC cycle, partly on its own higher frequency cycle. So that would be just sort of what I would expect Patrick to be doing when money markets are in stress.
So I'm apprising my supervisor and maybe all the way up to the board about economic and financial events as they occur. In the research staff, that's generally what we do, right? We don't say, gee, there's all this stuff going on, this should happen.
Okay. Yeah.
We say, there's all these things going on.
Right.
Here are some of the implications.
That was pure, I would call it sort of a pure, at that time, especially in the fall and summer and fall of 2007, it was really monitoring in real time what was happening, where the stresses were being felt, and how they were affecting investors and firms and sponsors.
What we would refer to as current analysis.
Right.
So, not hypothetically speaking, because you said maybe all the way up to the board, but do you remember trying to weave it into your analysis and it going up to the board?
On this topic?
I don't know about the specific topic. Certainly, the pressures that money funds were under was front and center from July 2007. Absolutely. If you remember, the FOMC and the board were making policy decisions in late July and in early August. So this information was absolutely flowing up to them. Whether I don't have any recollection of whether a tabulation of money fund support was part of any particular report or any particular information flow, but it was definitely part of a larger analytic flow of information that would have reached the board. Absolutely.
Just to give you an idea, at the time we were very concerned about the problems of financial guarantors and how that was impacting the tax-exempt money funds. And so, there were multiple things going on at this time.
Right.
Which of those...
Yeah, I just don't remember.
To where, I don't recall. And there was considerable concern in August 2007, right, as short-term markets, on a couple of days, they really looked quite dysfunctional.
Right. And one of the reasons that, if it was, maybe if we were talking in February of 2008, I might remember more about what literally made it to the board. But remember, those board meetings, Patrick and I are not attending those board meetings. So even if we're providing information up the chain, what's actually presented and then deliberated over among the board members is not something that we're typically privy to.
Well, if we were trying to look at this frame of time as Joel mm-hmm. is doing, and we asked to see what the wording of what went up, just to see trends at mm-hmm. in the information we received, is that something that you think would be useful for us to look at? Could we ask for that?
I don't know. I actually don't know it exists. I don't. Since I wasn't at the meetings, I don't even know the form of the information flow. Whether there are documents
I don't know.
I don't know.
That must be fun.
Yeah.
But there must be a PowerPoint or something you do for the next run above your level where you're briefing them about whether tax-free funds or money funds. Or
sometimes. Sometimes it's more like this.
Okay.
And it's a conversation over the table, and sometimes it's a more formal presentation. Like I said, on this particular topic, I don't recall.
You don't recall for 2007, or would it be?
Yeah, and especially in the context of the support, in that particular context, I just don't know. I don't remember what's available, whether there are anything formal or not happening.
Let me just circle back to one question where there is a fund that receives support from an affiliate, and that affiliate is a bank under your jurisdiction or a bank holding company. Do you have any views on that? Is that something that falls in your area?
No, anything that's supervisory in nature or dealing to do with rule writing or regulatory authority isn't something that typically would come over to the research division, at least not our part.
So if a bank cuts a check to prop up a fund, that's not in your area?
Yeah, that's a supervisory issue.
Now, I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit, but portals were... Are you familiar with portals?
Mm-hmm.
When did you first start seeing them come into play?
I have no idea.
Well,
when did I first hear about them? I'm sorry.
Like
I'm not
a year ago, or when you first started it? I mean, have they been around?
Sometime between those two periods. I'm really not going to speculate on when I first heard about portals.
Okay, and in the last, you know, since 2007, 2008... Have you looked at portals or...?
Not specifically at them.
Okay.
You know, I think like others, we were concerned about sort of the hot money effect of portals, okay. But we weren't looking specifically at portals. We were looking more at the funds.
So were you tracking hot money in any way to see where it came from?
How would you do that?
I don't know. I have no idea.
We don't have information about the investor classes, you know, the investor composition of different money funds, nor does anyone other than the individual funds, I believe. Pure speculation on my part.
Okay. So when you were saying you were interested and concerned about the hot money aspects, just summarize what you mean.
Just that this would potentially create greater... So if a portal facilitates an investor's ability to compare money fund yields, say, and to move money between funds and seek the highest yield, that gives an asset managers an incentive to reach for yield. And... I think that's the level of concern. So we're concerned about incentives, as we'd be concerned more broadly.
So over the past decade, has hot money always been out there, a concern?
Incentives for asset managers to take on greater yields have always been out there. And institutional funds, going back, say you went back 20 years, institutional funds are a far smaller share of money market fund assets in 1990 than they would be today. And so I think that the concerns about the risks, the special risks associated with institutional funds, and hot money as a subclass of that, would have grown over time, yeah, sure. And this was a concern, you know, the concern about the risks associated with institutional funds that was a subject of some discussion even before the crisis.
So is your concern with the institution?
The institutional funds.
Right, but when you're worrying, if you're concerned with hot money, is it the institution that's moving money from one high-yielding fund to one that yields even more? Are you worried about the investor institution? Or do you worry about it in terms of the fund that's receiving the hot money? What causes
I think
the most concern?
Broadly speaking, we saw a lot of, I think what you call market timing flows associated with institutional funds around the time of the easings in the 2001 to 2003 easing cycle. And that was very obviously institutional investors taking advantage of small pricing inefficiencies in the funds.
But I think in general, so it's the instability that could be associated with
absolutely
large redemptions that you would think are more of greater concern when there were recently large inflows. I guess that's the general way that we would be concerned. If money had just flown in to eke out a few basis points of yield, that looks like potentially fickle money, and we'd be worried about the ramifications of it suddenly flowing out. So yeah, that would be the type of concern that we would have.
That's And then to just expand on that, that's a broad concern, right? It's not just the investors. It's not just one class of investors that might be doing this. It's the effects on other investors, and then
on the
markets and the institutions that borrow in those markets and receive funding from the funds.
So a portal, to the extent the portal is able to accelerate all this, is that what concerns you, or is what would concern you with portals role here?
To the extent that the portals facilitate that type of comparison and yield seeking, I think there would be concern. I wouldn't highlight this as a primary concern of ours. I saw it on the list. I saw it on your list of questions as somewhat confused. I think we think the structural issues and instabilities associated with money funds are not specific related to the portals.
Right. I guess, right. So in a sense, I mean, it's not completely a sideshow, but I think we would say that the concerns would run deeper and broader than just that.
Okay. Let me jump forward to March of 2008, mm-hmm. Events associated with Bear Stearns. So leading up to that period, do you remember seeing any unusual activity in the money fund world?
Actually, no.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
And so this was a time, actually, when the concerns about financial guarantors were really becoming very severe. So there was a lot of focus on what was happening with tax-exempt bond funds. Excuse me, tax-exempt money market funds.
Right.
The prime money funds that had held bear were largely out of bear at that point. They were holding repo with bear, and we were getting reports, as I recall, from the New York Fed about kind of a day-to-day status of that sort of thing. But that was much more of a, I think that was a less concern running up to the Bear Stearns event than some of the guarantor problems, which,
right.
You know, ex post don't seem like much, but
right. At the time,
were very, very troubling. Yeah.
Is it fair to say that the Bear Stearns merger, did that per se prompt any particular money fund flows or activity? I don't recall. Remember?
No, I don't believe it was associated with anything dramatic. I have to go back and look at the data. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. But I don't recall that that was itself sort of looked like a triggering event.
So, am I hearing correctly? It's not that money funds actually held commercial paper, say, Bear Stearns commercial paper in their portfolios, that did not seem to be a problem, but instead you mentioned the repo market was somewhat of a problem with Bear Stearns.
Yeah, that's my recollection, that there was more exposure through repo, and again, the funds were pulling back from that, but the problem is that we didn't have good real-time data on exactly what, you know, who might be exposed. Even if you get 90% of the market, there's always a possibility there's a reserve fund or somebody out there who is not in your sample that isn't.
But it didn't really rise to our expectation. I think for most of the Bear Stearns stuff, I think you'd really have to talk to the New York Fed to really, in terms of the repo collateral and their positions and stuff there. I don't think either one of us are expert on that. I do think that unlike the fall of 2007 and later the fall of 2008, I don't think the Bear Stearns resolution was, caused particular money fund problems. That's my recollection.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was going to follow up a bit more with repo.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can ask, but it may be that we were
right.
Right.
So I guess in the scope of your research here at the board, would the repo market normally be an area that you would focus on?
Normally, no.
No.
Okay. And
it has
not in our area.
Yeah,
okay.
It has come under. I mean,
right.
Because it's money fund related.
Right.
We've, you know,
know, it's come to our attention.
Right.
Okay. So at the time Bayer was under stress, was it brought to your attention then? Did people start?
Yes, but it wasn't. It was brought to our attention, but it wasn't our central focus.
Yeah. Again, I think it was mostly happening in New York, and it's the analysis is happening in New York.
And I'm sorry, it's very difficult to distinguish in real time.
Right.
You know, when did we learn about these things? It's difficult for me to. It's almost speculation at this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's move forward in time a little bit further. Move the tape forward to, I guess, August of 07. August of 08.
Right.
So we all have the benefit of hindsight with Fannie, Freddie, AIG, Lehman, Merrill Lynch. I mean, all of that happened in a very short period of time.
Right.
How did that play out in the money market space?
Well, assets continued to grow right up until essentially the Lehman bankruptcy. So,
like,
literally.
It really is the. It really is. Is it literally like? I can't remember the days of the week, but it was. It was the Lehman bankruptcy that really triggered the alpha. I think it was
Monday.
Monday
the 15th.
And then I think by Tuesday.
Friday the 12th, there was some modest outflows from our. I mean, depending on how you want to look, but I would characterize them as modest outflows from the prime funds on the 12th on Friday. And then Monday, of course, the outflows really started. They were focused a little bit more on reserve itself and some of the funds that held Lehman. After the announcement on Tuesday, I think it was at 4 o'clock on Tuesday, that reserve was breaking the buck. I guess you could characterize it as all hell breaking loose. But both Monday and Tuesday were bad in terms of outflows. Wednesday and Thursday were more like catastrophic.
Right.
So how did you track that here? Because
right.
You described leading up to that, you really didn't have great information.
Well, we had been building information, I think, partly all since August of 2007. So actually, over time, I'd say we had built relationships and contacts in the industry with the SEC and with the New York Fed. Those are things that were evolving through the process. So by the time, I believe, that September 12th around was there, I think we had lots of contacts. Do you remember where the information was flowing immediately?
I personally started contacting money fund managers back in 2002, 2003,
right.
When there was a concern about low yields. We were trying to get information about what they thought would happen and, you know. So we had great contacts that we then turned to in 2007 as well during the SIV crisis. At the time of the Lehman bankruptcy, remember, so many things are happening so fast. A couple things. One, we did have daily flow data that would come to us a day late. The New York Fed, at this point, we'd essentially outsourced the contacts of the asset managers to the New York Fed because we just simply couldn't all be calling them every day. And what was going on was so catastrophic that in some cases the contacts were not being made by staff. They were being made at a very high level, is my understanding. So we had the information coming from directly from the funds through the New York Fed. We had daily assets and flows data coming from industry reports with a day lag. And then we had a range of other contacts that were, I would characterize as being more ad hoc. That could be with supervisory staff who are asking us questions. It could be with the SEC who are asking us questions. It could be us asking the SEC what's going on. But it was just a flurry of activity during that period, trying to understand what was happening and characterize it. I think My recollection was, though, that it was overwhelmingly clear that we were staring into the abyss, that there wasn't a bottom to this as the outflows picked up steam on Wednesday to Thursday. And so I think there's a, you know, we could talk about what we knew and when we knew it and what details and so forth. The overwhelming sense was that this was a catastrophe that we were watching unfold.
Did you go
from a staff level? Did I go home? Yes, I believe I did.
But we did have information that we felt we needed, spotty as it was, that told us pretty clearly in real time what was happening. So this is not a case where we were wondering, like we were going through work as if things were fine, and then only to find out 2 weeks later that it was not going well. This was something where, in real time,
we knew.
As close as ever, we knew what was happening. It was an easy, I mean, our expertise allowed it. This was a trivial extrapolation to recognize that Tuesday was not going to be the worst day that the most pressure that money funds and money markets were under that week. I think we had full confidence that that it would get worse until
we were watching,
you know, something stepped in to prevent it from getting worse.
We were watching a run.
Right.
So you asked me if I go home. I have a sort of personal story. I was supposed to leave for my honeymoon on Wednesday, September 17th, and I didn't. So I think that...
Yep. How's your relationship? Recovered?
No, my wife understood, actually. She was very, very good about it. And we did go that following Sunday after the AMLF and Treasury Guarantee had been... So
when you say, you know, this was huge, this was catastrophic, what made it so? Why was that weak?
There are two equilibria for money funds.
Right.
Everyone holds the fund and seeks high yields. No one holds the fund because you've had a bank run. Right? So Diamond and Dibvig made it very clear. people understood this for centuries, but in a institution that is performing liquidity transformation, where some of the assets are not liquid, once you've gone through your liquid asset stock and you are now trying to sell securities in a distressed market, the only direction for the fund's NAV is down. And so every rational investor has an incentive to get out of the fund.
And right. Did you ask or track where they were going?
I'm sorry?
Where
to the extent they were leaving these funds, where was that cash going?
Well, we know where some of it was going, although we don't know investor by investor,
right.
But you can look at the aggregates
in
and
the
see
aggregate.
And very clearly that a lot of it was going into, for example, treasury-only fund, money market funds, government funds, government and agency funds, and so that was quite clear fairly early on.
But that really, at this point, is a secondary concern where the money is going. The fundamental concern is that the process is in train that gives investors a very strong incentive to leave. Not just from a fund that it recognizes as being vulnerable, but just the mutual nature of the funds really does mean that if I just suspect that you will decide to pull your money out tomorrow, then I need to preempt you. And we knew that the dynamic was, that this structure was in place to trigger that kind of switch from stable, secure place to invest cash with ample liquidity to everyone try to get out before the next guy tries to get out. And so, you know, it was just that once you see the dynamic kick in, then you know it could happen very quickly.
If you and I are both...
So that's just what it really was. It was really an extrapolation of a sense that we had switched from the stable equilibrium to the unstable equilibrium. And
well, to the new equilibrium.
Yeah, right. It's actually quite stable.
It's very stable.
It's stabilizing, unfortunately.
And so just to be clear, the dynamic is that Michael and I are both shareholders in the same fund. And if I think that Michael thinks that the fund's NAV is going to come down, then I need to redeem. Even if...
Yep.
And now you actually, you've seen the event that is the Lehman bankruptcy and its effect on reserve. You've seen the event that actually makes this, it's more than just this, me trying to anticipate what Michael's thinking. I can see it myself.
So if you were advising, or at this point, you know, this point, Lehman's bankrupt reserve fund breaks the buck on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Right.
Tuesday, I think.
Yeah.
They broke the bucks the second Lehman. Yeah, but they didn't
report until Tuesday.
The SEC
four.
Did their thing.
Right.
So what were you telling people higher up or the Board of Governors? Why did this... You know, were you sending up reports? Were you sending emails? And if so, what were you saying the importance of this event is?
I don't think we were actually trying to characterize the significance of the event.
I think it was more factual. Right.
Here's what's happening to these funds, and just characterizing the types of information that we had at the time.
I don't think the board needed us to tell them that this dynamic was destabilizing for money markets and interbank funding markets. They knew that interbank funding markets were suffering, that short-term funding markets were under severe pressure. So we didn't... All we had to do is provide the information.
So
we didn't necessarily have to draw a conclusion, and we certainly didn't need to, you know, make a policy recommendation.
Our problem is our audience is the American public rather than the Board of Governors, so we're trying to encapsulate...
Oh, I see.
Okay, but
right.
So you didn't...
Let me go back to something you said. There was enough concern that, let's say, at the New York Fed, they were doing their own high-level conversations with fund managers or whoever their contacts were, you were saying, right? They were doing some of their own, right? So there's information being gathered in New York, and you all are doing it here in real time.
Uh-huh.
And it's moving very fast. So all we're trying to get a sense of, or I think I'm on the same wavelength here, is how... did all those data points come together to be useful to anyone who is in a policy making or crisis rescue situation that you know of?
Okay.
That you know.
So you're talking to two guys out of a whole bunch of people who have been involved in that process. But
So what it would typically happen is that Patrick, let's see, by 2008, Patrick may have gone to Josh Gallen, or he may have gone to me, or he may have gone straight to Nellie Lang, for example. We would have been in the officer line. The information would be conveyed to Dave Stockton, and at that point, Brian Madigan, and then Brian and Dave would be bringing the information to the chairman and the other board members. The chairman, the vice chairman, Governor Warsh, would be in close contact with the President Geithner at the New York Fed, and was it President Rosengren at the Boston Fed, and other members. So that's the part we don't know about.
So we would give
the information to Dave Stockton. If Stockton needed something, he would tell us what he needed. But in something like this, we knew the type of information that he needed, and because the reason we're a little vague about this is that what's unique about a case like this is that so many different people are arriving to the same conclusion with independent information. It matters much less, and I don't remember much, that what did we do that day? You would have gotten to the same point if, you know, I had been not at work that day. In other words, it's less obvious, but we would get the information to Dave Stockton. And Brian Maddock, that would typically happen at the same time.
And how did you do that? Verbal?
I would just to go back, this was just an extraordinary period. So we were getting communications not just up the chain, but from people you'd never heard of before.
Right.
Asking what
the question is, how did it go? And it would go face to face, or maybe through email, or maybe through memo. So this would be the ways that we would provide that information.
In conversations. Yeah.
Yeah, often on the phone. Yeah. So
with
something like this.
For urgency.
Yeah, this was urgent. So this would be the type of thing, again, that it just sort of depended on what the time frame was. But we would have been bringing this stuff face-to-face to Dave Stockton. So if, you know, if Patrick and I didn't see Dave, you know, for a three-week period in 2006, in 2008 fall, we were seeing him on a regular basis because this stuff needed to get to his attention right away. And then it was usually Dave or Brian Madigan, is my guess, who would deliver the information to the chairman. Now, the chairman, as best I know, already had that information. I'm not sure.
But
so that's what I meant about
it
being
corroborative. It was,
yes,
exactly. added value,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Okay. So that's how it would typically go. I don't think I personally ever met with the chairman on this topic, for example.
In this period.
Right, in this period. Whereas that was really going through the division directors, I suspect. And so, you know, I'm sure Scott Alvarez was involved and others were involved.
Okay. Let me just step back again, and the point I made is what the FCIC is drafting a report that, you know, for Congress and the American public, and we're trying to capture, you know, what events occurred, but also why they mattered. And both of you made some really interesting observations about, you know, this week was a big deal in terms of this particular product. And so my question is, why? What difference does it make in the scheme of things if reserve fund breaks the buck and a handful of others or dozens of other funds break the buck? Why does that matter? What does it do?
In isolation, let's do the reserve fund. I want to go through a hypothetical, okay, where reserve fund breaks the buck. Everybody recognizes reserve fund as, say, a rogue money fund who was really stretching the 2A7 rules as far as possible, and there's no sense in which the dynamic that ultimately we were quite concerned about was going to play out, then it's just not that big a deal. In a normal situation, you're talking about an investor in, I'm going to make these numbers up, Patrick probably knows the real numbers. If the only thing that was going on is that reserve fund shares were going to redeem at 97 cents instead of a dollar, in the scheme of things, that couldn't matter less. Except for, these are money funds or institutions that were created to satisfy the most risk-averse investor class. An investor class where the difference between a dollar and 99 cents is enormous, because you've gone from an asset that doesn't have any tax reporting, tax burden association with it. There's you never get a 1099 on your money fund as long as it doesn't break the buck, to really being a situation where the treasurers who are responsible for investing those funds were going to come out very badly if they were essentially reporting to the board even what looks like a minuscule, not a paper loss, but a real money loss. The type of thing that an equity investor suffers over any 2-hour period. So it was a recognition that the institution that was created to provide what I call infinite liquidity, the ability to redeem your shares or get your money back overnight at no risk of capital loss, all of a sudden, the capital loss part is brought into question. And so it was the concern. So had Tuesday and Wednesday played out with $426 million outflow, say after Bear Stearns, then we could have been concerned but somewhat mollified. Have those concerns a little bit mollified. But it was just recognizing, you know, the other thing is it's happening at a point in time where we knew that investor classes and counterparties all over were highly attuned to exposures. The Lehman bankruptcy and the AIG failures were themselves, they weren't just financial shocks, but they were actually, substantial confidence shocks. And so firms, that counterparties that had appreciated, that came to appreciate that a firm like AIG failed in a very short time frame. I don't remember, you'll know this better than I do, but the record is that AIG wasn't on a lot of people's red light list at the end of August, the way Lehman was. So Lehman, there was a financial shock associated with Lehman, but the AIG was happening at the same time, and that was in some sense a little bit of a different kind of a shock. So I think partly what's happening is that we knew that we were in a time period when anxieties were at a very high level, and then we saw the possible trigger of this dynamic, and then we saw the run actually start. And when we see the run actually start, that's where it really was concerning. In other words, there were no mitigating factors that we could identify. I think that was sort of what was happening, is we couldn't take comfort in a substantial mitigating factor until the Treasury guarantee and the AMLF have put in force. Then all of a sudden there's an actual backstop that means that if we can get investors to focus on the fundamentals and not have to be concerned that they need to run just out of concern that somebody else will redeem ahead of them, then we had the possibility, we didn't know it would work, we'd have the possibility at least of backstopping the system. And so that's what was happening. We knew that those backstops were not in place, right. And then we saw the run dynamic kick in.
So going with the run, what if there were no backstops put in place, what's wrong with the run?
Where
do you lean?
You've got on the order at that point of $2 trillion in assets in prime money market funds. They hold, at the time they held, and I think they still do, roughly 40%. You've seen the figures of all outstanding commercial paper. They own a substantial amount of bank certificates of deposit. They provide substantial funding in the repo market. The shock that Michael's describing is the importance of the sort of macro character of that shock is that because it's not just an idiosyncratic event, all investors now think that they're in trouble. Now all investors have an incentive to pull money out of their funds. Now, institutional investors, we think, are more aware of those incentives. If there are large-scale redemptions from funds, two things happen. One is they push the fund to potentially sell assets. And two, as we've discussed before, they create incentive for other investors to... They strengthen the incentive. They strengthen the economic rationale for other investors to redeem. The fund's assets are so massive relative to the secondary markets that could potentially absorb these assets that the secondary markets, commercial paper doesn't really have. It doesn't trade on exchange. If a fund wants to sell commercial paper before it has matured, so commercial paper typically has maturities of overnight up to 90 days, say. If you want to sell commercial paper before it has matured into a secondary market, you essentially have to place it back to a dealer. So dealers provide this as essentially one part of the liquidity service. So that's part of their role. The problem is that the dealers themselves, at this point, one of the big dealers is Lehman.
Right.
So the dealers themselves are under tremendous strain. We heard anecdotally from the funds that the dealers weren't even picking up their phones. The funds got to get rid of the paper. They don't have anyone to give it to. The markets just completely lock up. And so now you're looking at, in addition to the impact on the funds themselves, let's go to the primary market where many of these firms, including financial institutions, which are under strain, would normally be raising short-term funding. These markets shut down. And so now you have a bank that can't meet its daily liquidity needs. And you're starting to put not just the bank, but also I should mention non-financial corporations, which borrow in the commercial paper market. They use the funding to finance payroll. They use the funding for to finance receivables. So there's a non-financial element of this as well. All these things are put at risk once you start seeing massive outflows from the funds. So Michael's point is that once you've if you're just concerned about an idiosyncratic event affecting a $60 billion reserve fund, you think, well, that's a private matter. Once the contagion is spread and investors all see a strong incentive to get out of the funds, the immediate economic impact of that, not just financial, but economic impact of that can be quite severe. Right. And that's very well understood, not just by, I think, us, but broadly speaking, anyone who analyzes this market.
Right, I mean, really, two things I guess I wanted to say is, again, we were really cognizant of the fact that there weren't sort of backstops in the system that we're going to be resilient at that point in time against a shock like this. We knew the dealers were not sitting on ample capital and ample liquidity themselves to typically soak up some strain for a few days and to sort of keep things under pressure. We knew it. This was not a time when the commercial banks and the investment banks, had a bunch of liquidity and capital, again, laying around to be able to put in play, because typically when there's an idiosyncratic shock, there's often money to be made from stepping in and providing liquidity and taking a little bit of extra credit risk. But we knew the system was itself at its limits of what really could be provided. It wasn't the time to absorb another shock. It had already absorbed a few shocks, and so that was part of why at that time this was not a case where we needed to sit around and think about the possible ramifications. I think this was a case where partly we had just come to recognize more about the fragility that was in play at that time. But it really was, we were really talking about just a typical, like back in the 19th century, you would have bank runs, and the bank runs would just be the proximate problem was the bank doesn't have enough vault cash to satisfy all of its depositors. But the economic issue is that literally you can't make, the payment system collapses. And so that's that's not exactly what would have happened this time, but it's the functional equivalent to just the entire payment system breaking down, which was massively destabilizing in the 19th and early 20th centuries. In the United States, this was had a very similar dynamic to it. We were
one thing that I would point out is I think people were aware not just of these ramifications, but there was also considerable consternation. Right, this was an industry that was causing severe, because of its vulnerabilities, was causing severe strains elsewhere. I think there was, these are supposed to be private investment pools where investors take risk, and they should understand those risks. And so I think there was, considerable consternation about what was going on, as there had been for years, about the risks of money funds. But as Michael points out, there's just, once you are in this event, at that point, I think there was an understanding that we were headed towards the abyss.
Do the funds themselves in some way create this problem around the time of Lehman? Did the funds cut off either through repo or in some other mechanism, did they stop funding Lehman, which contributed to Lehman's collapse? Is that something?
I don't know.
Okay.
I can't speak to that per se. I mean, that's a complex research question, I'm afraid.
More generally, looking at Lehman, Merrill, Morgan, Goldman, whoever else was left at that time in September of 2008, I mean, one of the mechanisms that these money funds had for investing was through arrangements with these brokerage houses, right? So were you monitoring whether these funding mechanisms were continuing in September? You know, whether Lehman could still obtain. I mean, maybe it wasn't you. Maybe it was somebody else.
Yeah, I don't know.
Can we take a short break after the answer?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't think we know. I think that would have to go through New York.
So the New York Fed would they be. Would,
I don't know. Maybe they don't even know. I don't know. But we wouldn't know. Yeah, the SEC would have probably, again, the. Might know more about where Lehman's funding was coming from in real time, but certainly we wouldn't.
I'm 99% sure that I have no idea what the answer to that question is, but okay. I didn't fully understand the question.
Yeah, that's what worries me is you didn't understand, is that I didn't convey the question clearly. I mean, this basically has to do with the repo arrangements that the funds would be entering into and whether at a certain point in time the funds separately but collectively reach the same conclusion. We're no longer going to have this entity, whether it's Lehman or Morgan or.
So that's a good question. Whether any particular money fund who was a important funding source for Lehman changed its investment decision in late August through early September in a way that provided that caused a shortfall. We don't have any information about that, and we just don't know.
Because you can't know what they knew or what they thought.
The only way to know would be to have talked to, Federated or Fidelity or somebody, and I don't think we
don't
have those
conversations. Don't we need to know the daily assets of the funds?
Yeah, we just don't know.
The funding sources, the broker, it's I think it really is a deep and difficult question. I'm not sure that it's easy to establish this.
Right.
It's not just that I don't have information, but I'm...
No, you would have to talk to the fund managers themselves, I'd say.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if anybody who wasn't making the investment decisions knew. A market maker, I suspect. Might know. I don't know. But we would know.
Okay. So we'll regroup with repo, tri-party repo.
Okay.
Oh, this is really...